Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kevin Martin, President of Peace Action, who examines the complex web of issues that will drive negotiations in the U.S.-North Korean summit meeting later this spring. Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project, who assesses New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's executive order, restoring the voting rights of felons on parole supervision and similar efforts nationwide. And Suman Raghunathan, Executive Director of South Asian Americans Leading Together, who discusses her group's new report that documents the increase in hate crimes targeting South Asian, Muslim, Sikh, Hindu, and Arab communities across the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In January, Germany began enforcing a tough hate speech law that requires social media companies like Facebook and Twitter to remove illegal content within 24 hours. Among the first people caught up in the new hate speech law was far-right politician Beatrix von Storch, who objected to an official New Year's greeting in Arabic. The law, known as Netz DG, triggered objections from free speech advocates and political parties on the far right and left. At the same time, other nations with anti-democratic tendencies, including Russia, the Philippines, and Singapore, looked to adopt similar laws. But critics say the law puts too much power in the hands of tech companies, removing the courts from the process of arriving at a definition of hate speech. Since the end of World War II, Germany has had laws banning hate speech which targets minorities. The Christian Science Monitor reports that the inspiration for the law placing limits on speech posted on social media began in 2015 during the height of the flood of refugees pouring into Europe. In Munich, arsonists had attacked refugee housing, and far-right activists were posting threats and hateful comments on Facebook directed at refugees. German lawmakers are now looking at ways to reform the law only a few months after it took effect. Some legislators want to create an appeal process for users whose content has been deleted. Many also want to establish an independent body that would assess complaints and decide whether to remove content rather than to have social media companies do it themselves. In the months after Hurricane Maria battered Puerto Rico, tens of thousands of the island's residents fled north to Florida, New York, and Connecticut. As U.S. citizens, Puerto Ricans can register to vote once they establish their new residency. Democrats are optimistic that newly arrived Puerto Ricans will vote for their candidates in the 2018 midterm election. But Florida's Latino and Puerto Rican population is courted by both conservatives and progressives. Most Puerto Ricans living in Florida reside in the area known as the I-4 corridor in the central part of the state. Political strategists believe the increased number of Puerto Ricans could provide the margin of victory for incumbent Democratic Senator Bill Nelson to defeat his likely Republican opponent, Governor Rick Scott. Progressive activists are relying on strong anti-Trump sentiment among Puerto Ricans to mobilize voters in November. They say that issues like Medicare expansion, raising the minimum wage, and the damaging impact of the Trump GOP tax cuts on Puerto Rican-based businesses will help their candidates win. But as the American Prospect reports, Democrats must first overcome weak party institutions and a lack of investment by the Democratic National Committee in field organizing focused on get-out-the-vote efforts in Florida's Latino communities. The U.S. Census Department classifies 353 American counties as persistently poor, a designation that's given if over 20% of a county's population has been mired in poverty for 30 years or more. These counties are primarily located in the rural South and Southwest. In the American West, 21 counties have been designated as persistently poor, but there are none classified as such in California, home to nearly 500,000 farm workers. The reason, say experts, is that many of the state's rural poor don't actually live in rural counties. Instead, the state's large counties often include higher-income urban populations that hide substantial rural areas where persistent poverty exists, like Tulare County, an urban county with many middle-class and wealthy residents, along with Mexican migrant workers who earn $11 per hour. According to In These Times magazine, these counties are isolated geographically and lack resources and economic leverage. They have suffered from decades of disinvestment, in effect because the government defines poverty by profiling the county's population as a whole rather than by individual census tract. These counties are denied access to programs that could give them the first shot at funding initiatives available to high-poverty areas. And when California's cost of living is factored in against median household incomes, the state is considered the poorest in the nation, despite its stellar job and economic growth rates. More than 20% of California's residents, 8 million people, are struggling to pay their bills, prompting California State Assembly Republican leader Chad Mayes, who represents San Bernardino and Riverside counties, to declare poverty California's most urgent priority. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
In preparation for the widely anticipated summit meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in late May or early June, CIA Director Mike Pompeo secretly visited North Korea to meet with Kim in the North's capital, Pyongyang, over Easter weekend. Pompeo, who's Trump's nominee to become Secretary of State, reportedly was accompanied on the trip only by several U.S. intelligence officials. After the meeting, which was the highest-level direct talks between the two countries since the year 2000, Kim announced that North Korea was suspending its nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missile testing that had provoked bellicose threats from Trump over the past year. South Korean President Moon Jae-in is scheduled to have his own meeting with Kim to discuss normalizing relations on April 27th. Trump's April 22nd tweet stating that Pyongyang had agreed to dismantle its nuclear and missile programs was demonstrably false. This caused many observers to be concerned about the president's unrealistic expectations for an agreement on denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula at the summit meeting. There are also fears that if the summit ends in failure, it could lead to a dangerous escalation of tensions and renewed threats of war. Your reporter spoke with Kevin Martin, president of Peace Action and the Peace Action Education Fund, who examines the complex web of issues that will drive negotiations at the U.S.-North Korean summit meeting.
Upcoming this week will be this first summit between Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in, and I actually think that's the more important summit. If the two leaders of the two Koreas are able to continue to make progress, which it's been astonishing if you just look at, you know, just this year, in the few months of this year, astonishing progress towards peace and reconciliation. There's no reason to think that they won't continue to make progress. Just last week, they're talking about a peace treaty, and they're talking about relaxing the demilitarized zone between the two countries, which, of course, is a misnomer. It's the most heavily militarized patch of Earth. They've put so much on the table, I really have a hard time seeing how it's not going to be a success. Not that Trump or the United States or someone else couldn't foul it up later. But I do think this is the more important summit coming up this week. It'll set the context for future meetings, including with Trump and Kim Jong-un. And it's tempting to look at what are U.S. interests or Chinese interests or Japanese interests in the region. And you can't be naive. Those are all certainly factors. But this is about Koreans making peace. This is about the Korean people wanting a new path forward away from the confrontation that has been so dangerous for the last 70 years. And this is the Korean Peninsula we're talking about. It's not Florida. It's not Cape Cod. If the United States can't get behind this and support Koreans making peace, then we need to stay out of the way. But I do think that it'll be historic this week, and I fully expect that they will continue to make progress.
On the issue of North Korea's nuclear program, Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, announced that he was suspending his nuclear weapons and ballistic missile tests for the time being. But yet there seems to be some disconnect between the U.S. and particularly Donald Trump and North Korea when it comes to the term denuclearization. A lot of Korea observers think that it's a remote or non-existent possibility that North Korea will just junk all of its nuclear weapons here as an incentive to lift U.S. sanctions. What are your thoughts about the prospects for denuclearization on the Korea Peninsula?
I think that could go any number of ways. And of course, even if there is a difference in interpretation, let's just say for a minute, everybody, including South Korea and Japan, China, U.S., accepted the North Korea's interpretation that North Korea will get rid of its nuclear weapons if the United States ceases, what they say, introducing nuclear weapons into the region. Well, so what? We can still incinerate North Korea or any place on the planet, you know, with our ICBMs that are based here in this country. So I'm not sure why that issue is getting such play, unless or until the United States gets serious about getting rid of all nuclear weapons, which we should be doing, as should all the nuclear states.
What is the connection in your mind between the fate of the Iran International Nuclear Agreement that Donald Trump and his administration has threatened to repeal and the possibility of some substantive agreement between the U.S. and North Korea on North Korea's nuclear weapons?
It's very dangerous. Why would North Korea make an agreement with us if we're trashing an agreement we made just 3 years ago that everybody except Donald Trump says that Iran is complying with? It's just it would undercut any U.S. credibility and would almost be a signal that we're not serious about negotiating with North Korea. Listeners could call Congress 202-224-3121. We and other groups are doing a call-in day this week in support of something called the No Unconstitutional Strike on North Korea Act. In the Senate, it's S-2016. In the House, it's H.R. 4837. Easiest might be able to just Google No Unconstitutional Strike on North Korea. This is a way that Congress can stand up and say that we're for peace and diplomacy, and also that any president, not just Trump, does not have the authority to attack North Korea. And this is part of a broader conversation about Congress retaking its authority over declaring war.
That was Kevin Martin, president of Peace Action and the Peace Action Education Fund. Find more news and analysis on Korea negotiations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Prisons were in the news last week when a deadly fight among inmates broke out at the Lee Maximum Security Prison in South Carolina that resulted in 7 deaths and 17 injuries. The prison, like most others in the U.S., is seriously overcrowded, and education and other programs for inmates have been drastically cut back. Also last week, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced that he will restore, by executive order, voting rights to felons on parole supervision, a move that could open up the ballot box to more than 35,000 citizens. Many of those incarcerated were victims of the draconian New York State Rockefeller drug laws. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project, which researches conditions in the U.S. prison system, promoting policy reforms. Maurer says that even though conservatives often charge that actions such as Cuomo's executive order are politically motivated, since it is assumed the majority of people affected would vote Democratic, there's no data to back that up. In fact, both Republican and Democratic governors have initiated similar actions to reduce the long-term impact of incarceration on voting rights. Maurer adds that although the Trump administration, with Attorney General Jeff Sessions in the lead, are reversing many reforms put in place by the Obama administration, state governments have continued to lead efforts to reverse some of the worst abuses of the tough-on-crime era of the 1980s and 90s.
Governor Cuomo's executive order would potentially apply to the 35,000 people who are currently living in the community under parole supervision. More than half of that group, 19,000, are African American, reflecting the disproportions we see in the prison system itself. The executive order is a little ambiguous in part and says that there would be a review of people on parole for their restoration of rights. It's not clear if the governor's people have set up anything on that or what the criteria would be, but I think the intent of his executive order very clearly has been essentially a blanket restoration unless there are some unusual circumstances that come to light.
So there's a whole gamut of how states deal with voting rights of those convicted of felonies. Can you break it down for us? And we're talking about really huge numbers, right?
We have a total of 6 million people who can't vote because of a current or past felony conviction, but these are all dependent on state policies, which are extremely broad and varied in how they play out. At one end, we have two states, Maine and Vermont, where you never lose your right to vote, including if you're in prison. So people in those states are eligible to vote. At the other end, we have four states where any felony conviction results in a lifetime ban on the right to vote. And those four states are Florida, Virginia, Kentucky, and Iowa. Now, it is possible to get a gubernatorial pardon in those states, but the underlying ban is lifetime, and it's across the board. And among the other states, it's a mix of restrictions depending on whether you're in prison or on probation or parole, and there's a wide range there as well.
Mark Maurer, do these folks get something when they leave prison or a letter in the mail? Do they have to go to the polls and see if they can vote? How does it work in practice?
In most states, unfortunately, there's no means by which the state informs people about the right to vote, regardless of whether the state is restrictive or relatively lenient in this regard. But it's rare that you get a piece of paper the day you leave prison saying this is how to register to vote, or the day you're off parole, or the like. So there's been a lot of confusion about this, a lot of misinformation. This recently led to a case in Texas where a woman who was on parole, served her time in prison, now living in the community, working under parole, she went and voted in a recent election. Never occurred to her that she didn't have the right to vote. She was prosecuted for voter fraud and recently sentenced to 5 years in prison for voting while she was on parole, and 5 years for just trying to exercise her right to vote. Her argument was that she didn't have any idea about the fact she couldn't vote. No one in the correction system told her it should be the obligation of every state correction system to inform people about if and when they regain the right to vote and what the procedure is for doing that.
Have there been any studies showing what impact having the right to vote, even perhaps while incarcerated, has on any other aspect of people's experience of incarceration or post-incarceration?
Well, we don't know very much about it. The only reports we have in Maine and Vermont is that it's a relative handful of people who do exercise the right to vote. But, you know, when it comes to the right to vote, regardless of the group involved, if only even one person chooses to exercise that right, you know, it's really the fundamental principle that we need to be concerned with. And then once we extend the right, you know, to make sure people take advantage of it. There's a fair amount of literature on reentry from prison and the like that, you know, makes a strong argument that for people to succeed in the community, they need to have investment in the community. They need to be connected in various ways. So, you know, that means good family connections. It means having a job or schooling to participate in. But it also means things like electoral participation. People who are committed to the future well-being of their community are going to be less likely to go out and return to committing crimes. There's not a lot of heavy-duty research on that, but it certainly makes sense intuitively as part of a whole reentry process that people go through.
That was Mark Maurer, executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based Sentencing Project. Find more news and commentary on efforts to restore the voting rights of those who've been incarcerated by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Since the election of Donald Trump in November 2016, the United States has witnessed a disturbing increase in hate-inspired violence targeting members of South Asian, Muslim, Sikh, Hindu, Middle Eastern, and Arab communities across the U.S. This spike in attacks, driven by racism and xenophobia, has been documented in a new report titled Communities on Fire, researched and published by the group South Asian Americans Leading Together, or SALT. The report concludes that the rise in assaults on specific American minority communities runs parallel with a surge in the Trump administration's anti-Muslim policies and rhetoric. SALT's report documented 302 incidents of hate, violence, and racist rhetoric aimed at racial, ethnic, and religious minorities, of which 82% were motivated by anti-Muslim sentiment. The 302 incidents cited represent more than a 45% increase from the year prior to the 2016 election campaign, levels not seen since the aftermath of the September 11th terrorist attacks. One in five perpetrators of these violent incidents invoke President Trump's name, his administration's policies, or his campaign slogans while they were engaged in such attacks. Your reporter spoke with Suman Raghunathan, executive director of South Asian Americans Leading Together, who summarizes her group's Communities on Fire report and explains how civil society groups are coming together to combat racist-inspired hate and violence associated with a Trump presidency.
SALT has been looking at hate crimes and hate violence as well as xenophobic political rhetoric for the better part of a decade. In particular, hate violence, our analysis on hate violence has been far longer, frankly, than the FBI when it comes to attacks on Muslim, Arab, Sikh, Hindu, and South Asian American communities. What I can tell you right now, Scott, is that our nation is confronting a wave and really a surge in attacks on our communities that we have not seen since the events of September 11th. And in fact, at this current moment, really are pointing to a far, far larger scale of violence against our communities. And unfortunately, tragically, what we are seeing and what we were able to document in Communities on Fire is the reality that the current policies of the Trump administration, candidate Trump's political rhetoric, and the current statements from the White House are really emboldening and actively encouraging acts of violence against our communities and really continuing to draw us further down a road of racial animus that our country has not seen for the better part of 50 to 60 years.
Suman, how can we make direct links, if any, that correspond to the rhetoric used in the presidential campaign in 2016 by Donald Trump and his supporters and the violence that we've seen increase since that campaign got underway?
That's right. Well, what I can tell you is that we have seen for the last few years significant upticks in hate violence affecting the many communities that I already outlined. 82% of the incidents we documented, as well as our communities documented, were animated by anti-Muslim sentiment, regardless of their target. And perhaps most chillingly, Scott, one in five of the hate violence perpetrators we documented in only 1 year immediately after President Trump's election explicitly referred to President Trump, a Trump policy such as the Muslim ban, or a Trump campaign slogan like Make America Great Again, as they were violently assaulting one of our community members. So for us, a link that we have been very frankly worried to make conclusively for quite some time is now actively and clearly documented between what's coming out of the mouths of our current political leader and the policies coming out of the White House and how they are indeed actively encouraging people toward violence.
Suman, given the prospect that we might have a Supreme Court weigh in and uphold the Trump Muslim ban, what is the recourse for your organization and other civil rights groups around the country? With our Republican Congress right now, it doesn't seem they would stand up to Trump or pass any legislation that would undercut the Muslim ban, what would your group be engaged in if such a decision were rendered by the justices there at the Supreme Court?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm proud to report that there is actually a piece of legislation that is bicameral in both the House and the Senate that would effectively end the Muslim ban and really reverse it. That's one core piece that if the Supreme Court does indeed decide to uphold the Muslim ban, that we can, again, use to push back. I can say that our communities have remained united, not only with ourselves, but really aided by and with the solidarity of so many other communities of color, from dreamers to law professors to grassroots activists, including Latinos, Africans, Eastern Europeans, you name it. We all know that the fight and the current debate on the Muslim ban before the Supreme Court is really something that affects all of us. And we know that it's up to us to continue to keep up the pressure on this administration to, should the Supreme Court uphold the Muslim ban, know that they cannot move forward with continuing to implement it, that simply by virtue of an executive order that can be rescinded or reversed, that the ethos and the impact of the Muslim ban has no place in this country. And I think the final piece that I'll say is also that a huge majority of Americans are in strong opposition to the Muslim ban. Voters across the country know that the Muslim ban and its impact and its ethos are un-American. And I think we have continued to see voters across the board, regardless of their political affiliation, realizing that policies such as the Muslim ban are not who they are and are not who we are as a nation.
That was Suman Raghunathan, Executive Director of South Asian Americans Leading Together. Find a link to a copy of Salt's Communities on Fire report by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPPP in Athens, Georgia, KKFI in Kansas City, Missouri, KAOS in Olympia, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.